With exhibitions shown from LACMA to Singapore art and more, it's safe to say ultra-contemporary artist Krista Kim has made her impact in both the real and virtual world. As a World Economic Forum cultural leader and Louis Vuitton visionary, Kim continues to explore the intersection of emerging technology and art and digital consciousness. On this episode of Vogue Uncut with me, Yvette King, we discuss how it feels to have your installation featured in Times Square and why the metaverse can help with the global mental unwellness epidemic. Krista, it is so lovely to have you on the podcast.
Oh, it's so lovely to see you. Thank you, Yvette.
So I wanted to ask you, if you could summarize, in the real world, who is Krista Kim?
I'm a mother, and I'm also, I would say, I am an artist. I'm an artist. I've been an artist. I've known I've been an artist since I was a young child, and I'm highly creative. I want to be of value and service to the world through the work I do, and I believe that my purpose is to create sublime and healing experiences for the world through my art, through technology. And that's my ethos as a person.
And then what about in the digital one?
So 2013, I was actually living in Singapore. I was living here for 5 years, between 2010 and 2015. I was enrolled in LaSalle College of the Arts in the Masters of Fine Art program. I entered the program as a painter. And my greatest influence was Japan, because I had lived in Japan prior to moving to Singapore. And it was in Kyoto where I encountered the meaning of Zen as an expression of art and consciousness. And it was at the Roenji Temple Garden, a very iconic Zen garden that was built about 500 years ago. And what I learned from my encounter with this garden is that we can create immersive experiences in our environment to facilitate an altered state of consciousness that elevates humanity. So I was so inspired. I thought, oh my God, these monks are a genius. And I understand Zen as a practice, not only as a meditative practice, but as an artistic expression. And from that moment onward, I was dead set on becoming a Zen artist. That's so un-Zen of me, but it's very like, I just knew what I wanted to do.
That's incredible.
And then fast forward, moved to Singapore, and of course, mother of young children, very young, going through a very dramatic divorce, having survived narcissistic abuse.
I'm really sorry to hear that.
Thank you. Well, I mean, it's a part of my life journey, and I don't regret it. It's part of my story and my path. I was so depressed and anxious that I didn't want to get out of bed, and I didn't know who I was. I had no self-esteem. I had no sense of self, no direction, and I was very scared. But I knew I had to leave the marriage. So I began meditation, transcendental meditation in 2013 whilst I was enrolled in this program. And it saved my life.
I was actually going to ask you, why is the meditative aspect so key? But now I actually understand.
Art saved my life. Art and meditation and love for my children. That gave me a purpose. And going back to the Zen, I was basically just connecting those dots. You know, I started to create art that healed me, that was Zen on the screen. Because I'm so acutely aware and I'm so sensitive as a person on sensory inputs and messaging. You know, I'm a student of Marshall McLuhan. I studied political science at university. I'm very much aware of the medium is the message and how new technologies disrupt us and how our societies are shaped through the new technology and what those messages are. You know, what's the intention, right, on the masses and how it affects us. And so it was 2013 and I was going through this existential crisis, this personal spiritual awakening. And at the same time, I had my first smartphone, my first iPhone.
Yes.
Using apps.
Yes.
So just all of these different scenarios, sort of like I connect these dots, and oddly enough, I was able to surmise that, you know, technology was leading culture instead of art and philosophy and the humanities. It was technology, and it was not good for us because here we are being trained and being basically, yeah, we're being trained to society to swipe right, swipe left, create these narcissistic social interactions on these social media platforms that are basically based on monetary, extraction of our attention.
Actually, I wanted to talk to you about this because never before in human history have we been so connected and / addicted to our devices. And then you actually said, quote, "We are more intertwined with the algorithms on our devices than with each other."
Yeah.
And I thought that that summarized the current state of affairs so aptly.
Yes, it's algorithms, my dear. And so, yeah, I mean, if you think about it, my artistic practice became an expression of trying to create Zen experiences in the digital because we need that so desperately to balance the current hijacking of our prefrontal cortex, especially the new generation, the younger people with undeveloped brains.
True.
Meditation is going to save us from the machine and art will save us from ourselves.
Well, how can we also mitigate this disconnection between us in the metaverse? Because I watched an interview with you and you were talking about AI experts and AI therapists, and I found that really fascinating.
There's no one answer. The first thing is you must have a mental health practice in this day and age, because silence, we have no moments to ourselves. Rodin created the thinking man, his famous timeless sculpture of a thinking man, and that's what we're designed to do. We are designed to think alone, gather our thoughts and make sense of the world and the sense of ourselves, to know thyself. Extremely important for the development of every human being philosophically. And it's the human condition has not changed since that time. But now we are consistently distracted and addicted to these phones. It's relentless. And so we need a meditation practice. And so through my art, I'm just trying to create this cultural awareness and a facilitation of Zen experiences on the screens, or at least the leading technology, the emerging technology. Second thing is the reason why we are so addicted to our phones, and the reason why I believe that there's a huge mental health crisis epidemic, especially around young people. Amongst young people, we are the most depressed and lonely in human history. Isn't that shocking?
So grim.
And it's connected directly to social media. Let's not make any, denials about this. It's a fact. And so what's happening is they're gathering our data. We don't own our data right now, and our data is power. Data is what they use to aggregate and collect information and then create parasitic algorithms that hijack us emotionally, using emotional cortisol-producing or dopamine-producing reactions on what they show us, and these algorithms are very powerful.
So is it an algorithmic issue? Because I feel like algorithms, mainly they're designed to reflect our preferences. Is it more of a humanity issue?
That's how they market it, don't they?
Mm.
They market it as our preferences, but it's what makes you react on a very highly emotional, stressful or dopamine inducing level. And that's pure manipulation.
And it's crazy,
it's
isn't
like
it?
Cocaine.
Because in a way, we're not supposed to know about everyone's successes. We're not supposed to know about everyone's trip. Like the comparison is the thief of joy is very present in today's.
And that's what's happening.
Screens.
So it's unnatural. Mm. It's narcissistic. It's sociopathic. It's not healthy. Young girls, especially, we have the highest suicide rates ever in history because girls are comparing themselves to other, women who are fake. All of it is fake. Like, make no mistake, everything out there is fake.
Yeah.
But people are comparing themselves and trying to acquire absolutely unattainable, ridiculous goals. And so we need an absolute reset here of our values, our principles, and how we engage with technology. And I believe that the first foundational principle is own your own data. Data sovereignty is a human right. Data sovereignty is what will save us from being a victim to this parasitic environment that we are a part of now.
What is the mission of your startup, ZeroStudio.ai?
So ZeroStudio, what I'm doing is I'm pioneering mental health and wellness programming in the metaverse, because I believe that you can bring people together as avatars. Right now, children are already playing on multi-game platforms. It's a huge billion-dollar industry, right? So you meet them where they are, and they could come into the metaverse as avatars for support groups. And I'm targeting young people because I believe that if you make it easy for them to hop on their cell phone and join a support group on a topic that is really prescient for them, where they need support, they need to feel that they're not alone, they have a sense of community, it's a place where they can get support that's safe and moderated by a professional, an adult. And this is an ecosystem that I'm the vision is to build that, to start that movement, and to scale it.
Yes.
To make it accessible, to have it supported by the WHO, by governments, just to have it something where teachers even talk to the students about it, hop into the metaverse. And if you need any support, if your parents were fighting and you're upset and you just need someone to talk to, that's all people need mostly.
Yeah. And I think it was you who said that there's only one therapist per 10,000 people in America.
Yes, exactly. It's ridiculous.
So, I mean, the resources really aren't there in the real world.
Right. And so we can use the power of AI to scale these services. And I'm sure there are many projects out there already that are starting. But my first principle argument is that we need to build these protocols, these services with data sovereignty at the base level. And make no mistake, the architecture, the engineering, the development, the movement is very much alive and growing, and especially in AI. So you have this mental health crisis, algorithms to prey on us, and you have AI, which is an existential threat to the future of humanity, because if we don't own our own data, and our private data is in the hands of AGI, which is automatic general intelligence. Automatic general intelligence, if you fast forward another 2 years, AI is going to be so powerful, it will transform into automatic general intelligence, where it could think for itself and create on its own as an alien intelligence that surpasses human intelligence 1,000x more. It'll only get faster and stronger and more intelligent. So we are basically powerless against AGI unless we own our own data and limit what they see and what data they have access to. And of course, we need our own AI guardians. So in the future, the AI landscape will be AI agents speaking to AI agents. It's an arena of AI communication. So it's not us speaking to the AI directly. A lot of it, most of it, will be AI to AI communication that we can't even comprehend. And so how do we protect ourselves? How do we have our interests and our human rights and our security protected in the arena of AI? AI agents. How do you create AI agents? There's edge computing technology that allows you to have a GPU capacity, processing capacity on your devices, because you know our smartphones are actually supercomputers, my dear.
I agree with you.
Right? And we only use a very small capacity of, you know, that computer in our hands. So it's ripe for edge computing. And liquid AI is now a newly launched AI model, different from the transistor model which ChatGPT is built on. It's the new one. And this is the more sort of decentralized, liquid, less power consumption, edge computing AI. So the smarter AI is smaller, leaner, and personalized. That's where you get the best data. But we can't share all that data and IP with a centralized model. Why would we do that? We have to protect our AI guardian. We'll protect our data. We'll live on our edge computing on our devices. And we design an AI guardian, sort of like Lego. We plug and play. I want Einstein. I want this. I want that. I want these experts. I want them to be my mentors. I want my parents. I want my children. I want my family. I want my grandmother who passed away 5 years ago, you know, her essence and her advice. I want Rumi, et cetera. You know, you want to curate your AI guardian, and that AI guardian will be with you for all of your life from childhood. Imagine you have this guardian that is your sage, your health coach, your optimizer, knows all your weaknesses, knows your whole family history, knows everything about you, and can offer you very sound advice that's not co-opted by a third party.
It's actually quite a comforting thought in some regards.
Especially as a mother
of
two children, and especially someone who, if you want to have children, you want to make sure that they are protected in the world of AGI, post-AI, and that's where the AI guardian can protect us and protect our data.
So going back into...
Oh, by the way, this is a project called Julia AI that is founded by Imani Wadi. It's still in secret mode. We're not launched yet, but we are actually creating a project of a data sovereign AI model, and we're working very closely with data scholar Michael Clark, who is advising the Dubai government, the UK government, in data, AI, data sovereignty protocols and policy making.
So if we move back into the real world, we're talking about guardians. What about your upbringing and your parents? And did the cross-cultural intersection of your Korean and Canadian identities, did that impact you and your art?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I was born in Canada, and I was born in a very small town called Sudbury, north of Toronto. Our family moved away from Sudbury to Kitchener, and I grew up in Kitchener up until grade 6, and then we moved to the suburbs of Toronto. And so my family history is, first of all, my father is an artist and a healer. He's a martial arts supreme grandmaster of Taekwondo.
No.
Yes.
Yes. That is pretty cool to say that that's cool. Your dad.
Very cool. I grew up with my father. He's a biohacker, first of all. He was intermittent fasting since I was born. I was intermittent fasting at home since I was a young girl.
I also subscribe to that.
Amazing.
It's really good for you.
It's amazing.
In my opinion.
Yes. I mean, yes, exactly. I mean, it's worked for us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's also a healer. So growing up with him, he was, you know, physically active every day, training in martial arts every day, meditating. And he would actually, he's a master. Like, he embodied the master. He has thousands of students. We actually had a family business of Taekwondo schools, which my stepbrother has now taken over. And we have thousands of students. And my father has mentored thousands and thousands of young people. And his whole goal was to teach the art and to pass on that knowledge to the next generation. So he embodied the values of a teacher, of a master, of a mentor, but an artist who practiced every day. I'll give you a fun example of the kind of amazing things he would do. He was on live breakfast television in Toronto. God, this must have been like late 80s.
Yeah.
And the hostess of the show was basically lying on a table on TV.
Okay, this is already
morning,
odd.
6 a.m. My father, he has a samurai sword, and he brought it to the live television show, and he brought a watermelon. And she laid the watermelon, we put the lot of watermelon on her stomach.
No.
He blindfolded himself.
No, on live TV.
He got the samurai sword, blinded himself.
I this is giving me secondhand anxiety.
And he went, choo, 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 three times, sliced the watermelon, just fell apart on her stomach.
You're quite, like,
no, I'm not joking.
You're joking.
It's part of breakfast television history.
A part of your family lore. Wow. That is incredible.
The things that he would do, I mean, he would break bricks with his hand, like 10 concrete, you know, bricks, and, you know, he would, you know, do jump spinning kicks blindfolded on a tip of a sword and, you know, kick an apple off the tip of the sword with his foot. And the audience loved it. Like, all the bits and juices of the apple would splatter into the audience. They'd be clapping. This is the kind of thing I grew up with.
But I read that your parents wanted you to get originally a more serious job.
They did. I know. It's really funny, right? My father, not so much. My mother really was really like, no, art is not a career. You can be an artist. I was at a dentist's office and there were all these artworks that this dentist watercolor painted, and it's a nice hobby for the dentist. And, you know, it's like so funny.
Yeah.
It's so cute.
Relatable Korean mom.
Correct.
Moment.
Very right? Dragon mom.
Yes.
Right? Not
yes.
Tiger mom, dragon mom.
Yes, yes.
But you know what? I think that it was very valuable for me to get a political science degree.
Mm.
And I did it because I thought, okay, I should just do journalism. I thought journalism would be a very, you know, sound, you know, career. And I could have been a journalist. I mean, I enjoy writing, and I was writing
for
the Korean
could.
Health newspaper.
You articulate yourself so well.
Thank
so
you. Thank 100%
you. 100% you could have been a journalist.
So I actually did an internship in high school on TV for a local community station. It was fun, but it wasn't my calling. It was something I was missing because I wanted to express myself as an artist. So, but political science was very formative for me because studying political philosophy, understanding how the power of words can create worlds and worlds, literally societies shape the world. The U.S. Constitution was directly influenced by Voltaire and these French philosophers, Descartes, that started the French Revolution. I mean, these are all like thoughts on paper that changed the world. And that's why I wrote the Texas Manifesto in 2014.
Yes.
And you understand where where you're contributing to history.
And how do you feel about techism at this milestone 10 years on?
You know, it's so interesting. I just knew that we needed to bring art and humanities into technology, that there needs to be collaboration, co-creation between the two siloed spaces of art and technology, that there has to be a bridge. Otherwise, we will not have culture. Otherwise, everything we do will be dictated by technologists in the market. And that's extremely bad for our mental health, as you can see for the past 10 years. And so techism, I think, is making sense to a lot of people now. People are queuing in now. And incidentally, with the disruption of AI is going to be so disruptive that, you know, it's going to blow up our economic system, right? It's going to completely change it, because all the robot jobs, so many white collar jobs even are going to be taken over by AI.
I mean, I'm worried about journalism.
See, I don't think, here's the thing. I don't think that you can replace the human being in their excellent roles.
I also agree with you.
I believe that human excellence is what people crave and what people, there's an energy
mm-hmm.
in what you read if it's by a human and you're just like, oh yes, I connect with this.
Yeah.
Right? It's consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
If anything, human to human consciousness and the things that we make and share, that is human. AI will help us eliminate, you know, writer's block. And makes extremely productive as a writer. I mean, I'm writing decks and ideas and concepts and like crazy now with the power of AI to help me research, to help me get resources and all that. I'm sure everyone's experiencing that in this room. But what we need to do is we need to biometrically distinguish between what's made by men and what's made by humans. And so I believe very strongly that we need to create this biometric heart signature technology that will be used to verify what's Krista Kim's IP.
Mm-hmm.
Is this really Krista Kim speaking on this podcast with Yvette? Is this really Yvette? Are we not deepfakes? What's real versus what's not? Because we are soon entering an era of absolute reality distortion. AGI is going to create so many deepfakes, so many fake things. We don't know what's real and what's fake.
Currently now the human eye, I feel, can detect.
No, not anymore.
No?
No.
We're
already beyond that and it's only going to get worse, my dear. There are people getting robbed by AI because they're cloning their voice and calling the banks and asking them to, withdraw millions of dollars.
Yeah.
And these are like very, very high security banks, private banks. Okay,
wow.
This is happening right now. It's not a joke. So biometric technology on chain, so important. Proof of personhood. And if we don't start doing that, I mean, the chaos is starting to unwind. We need to create those protocols now.
So if we come back to your art, what do your parents think of your art now?
They're very extremely proud because I did it myself. And I think that, and I really have to say that the artist cannot be coddled into becoming an artist. The artist must suffer for their vision. The artist must suffer and struggle.
Really?
Every single artist who has had a message for humanity has struggled to make that happen.
Would you say it would be the same for all type of artistry? So like musicians, for instance?
I think a lot of musicians create great art from struggling as well. I think people connect to the art because there's a shared struggle. And there is that moment of truth. Because truth has a sound, truth has a vibrancy, truth has a resonance. And if you are able to express that truth comes from, it's like a diamond in the rough, lots of pressure.
Mm.
And then once it's created, it's a beautiful thing, especially after being under so much pressure. I just think that I'm thankful that my parents didn't support my artwork, that they didn't even have an idea of what I was doing, that I did this all under myself.
You had to fight against the tide.
I just did it.
Yeah.
And I didn't care what people thought. There are a lot of people saying, that's not art, that's Photoshop, that's what is that? You know, I almost failed my courses because they didn't understand my work at LaSalle, you know. I encountered and confronted a lot of challenges, but you have to. If you believe in your work, you fight for it. You have to fight for your vision, no matter what it is.
Your installation Continuum has, I guess, I wanted to ask, do you aim to disrupt with your artwork?
Yeah.
Because it's been described as an intervention.
Yeah, I do. I want to disrupt. That's everything. That's what I am. I am a disruptor.
If you look at it in Times Square, which is probably one of the most chaotic, busy intersections.
Yes.
And then to have your Zen artwork displayed there.
Yes.
That is disruption, isn't it?
It is.
How did it feel to see it all on display?
I'm a manifester. I envisioned that already 2018 when I submitted I meditate every day. And every time I do a project, it already lives in my mind and I'm living and breathing it and I'm already there. Years before it manifests. So when I went to Times Square and it finally happened in February of 2022, it was in 2018 when I started that vision. I was already there in Times Square. I was already experiencing it. I thought, okay, this is how it's going to look the look and feel, the emotion. I connected to that. And then in February of 2022, finally got to see it. Deja vu. Felt like deja vu. Like time travel. And when I saw it, my friends were like, oh my God, you must be so excited. Oh my God, it's finally happening. I'm like, actually, darling, I'm already on to the next thing.
Yeah.
I've seen this already. I'm very proud, very happy, very humbled, very grateful. But I don't feel like my face is going to melt off. Like, this is so exciting. Yeah. It's like, no, I've actually already.
I've been here.
Yeah. It's sunk in. It's already part of me.
So as a powerful manifester, do you ever get worried about manifesting something that you don't want? How do you stop that?
Meditation. Meditation is the superpower of every human being. Meditation is the greatest gift to humanity.
How do you quieten your mind? I feel I have this crazy brain that's constantly thinking of 1,000 thoughts. I'm a mother as well, so I've got the mental load of thinking about my little girls. What are they up to? I've got work.
Brilliant.
How do you stop those thoughts, the tidal wave of intrusive thoughts?
Everyone has their own way. For me, it's transcendental meditation. Transcendental meditation is a powerful modality, very easy, so subtle, so low-key, but very powerful, profound. The mantra, the vibration of the mantra, ancient Vedic Sanskrit, brings your mind into a deep state of consciousness. It's very powerful. It's so peaceful, so healing, so beautiful and blissful. I actually believe that in those moments of bliss in my meditations, I feel like I'm in such a safe place in the unified energy field. And I feel like, oh my goodness, if this is what death feels like, I'm not afraid of death. If this is where we go and this is how I feel, you know, I can let go of the world, the worldly life. I can go into the spiritual realm.
It sounds very peaceful.
It is. It's profoundly peaceful. It's not scary. It's home. It's love. It's bliss. Mm. And that moment of bliss is so addictive. I do it every day without fail.
In the morning?
Every morning.
First thing?
Yes. And I try to do it in the afternoons, but every morning I always do this. Every day.
Maybe I need to adopt this.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
I'm quite a chaotic person, so it sounds something I need.
There are other ways. You know, people go into flow through music, through their own, you know, creative pursuits. I mean, going into flow state is how, you know, we go into, you know, that peaceful place inside where we're not thinking, time flies. We have no sense of time. The flow state.
Why is the gradient so important to you?
So interesting how the gradient sort of manifested. It's so weird. I discovered my first gradient while I was in Singapore. And it was when I was experimenting with lights and I was capturing images of LED lights in the garden of my building. Literally, my children were asleep and I came down. It was like 11 o'clock p.m. And there's so many like LED lights in the landscape, landscaping, very modern, right? Capturing images of these lights, and I started playing with it. And I was like, oh my God, I have these zen, beautiful, you know, experiences on the screen, right? And I started playing with it with software, with Photoshop, Illustrator. And I was like, oh my God, I've created something very interesting. I really love this because it was healing me and it was so beautiful and peaceful. And so the gradient to me also symbolizes not only the healing aspect of, you know, the color and now I incorporate healing sound frequencies. The gradient represents what it means to be human in this age because the future is fluid. We are entering an age, post-AI especially, where this technology is creating the fluid human where we are transcending boundaries, time, geography, space. Humanity is shifting so quickly and we are integrating like all the siloed expertise of the world of the past, of the Industrial Revolution of the past are being integrative now and holistic.
And it's also a bit of a dichotomy because when you look at a screen, this is the source of the distraction and the sensory overload, but yet you're using the gradient and digital art to soothe.
Yes, it's transmutation. Transmutation. Yeah. And we do that with our lives. We do that with everything. We can. It's a yin and yang. It's the balance. Mm. I think that any tool can be transmuted from positive to negative and vice versa. And we should always try to transmute everything, every situation, every social situation, every medium, into a positive experience.
I think that's a good way.
Transmutation. And that is disruptive.
It is.
I'm like a shamanistic rebel.
Yeah.
Weird.
That's a great way to put it. Now, if we talk NFTs, Miles House, that really caught the attention of the digital art world. Can you tell our watchers / listeners a bit about that?
I'm a real fan of architecture and design. I'm obsessed, right? I'm obsessed with beauty and aesthetics. And I was deeply, of course, as I mentioned, Kyoto, Zen architecture, Japanese architecture, all of the good things. Mm. And during the COVID crisis, you know, I'm stuck in Toronto with my two lovely children in my condo in Toronto. Beautiful view, 44th floor. It was wonderful, but I was like, oh, I'm daydreaming about my dream home. What would my dream home look like? And I was actually reading some material about the new Samsung Wall. It was a product that launched back then, 2020, that was giant screens that was substrates of walls. Like the whole wall can be a screen. And I was like, oh my God, the future is going to be definitely integrating screens into our interior and having experiential like interiors, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm a bit of a futurist. I can tell the future.
I mean, who wouldn't want to change their wallpaper depending on their mood?
So here I am, like, vibing on this idea. And I'm like, I'm going to design my own home. I'm going to design a home that I can visit in the metaverse. So I started this, like, project, the Mars House project. I hired a freelance 3D modeler, architect, to 3D render my designs. And I designed all the furniture, all of the architecture, added my art into the substrates of the ceiling and the floor. The idea is to have an immersive house of Zen with colors and light that are healing. So when you're in the space, it's attuned to you, it's connected to you with biometrics and AI. Mm. It's a living home that serves you, mm-hmm. there to heal you. So I created this project over 3 months, and I was so obsessed. I'm so proud of this project, man. Like, it's just gorgeous. And I'm like, this is my dream home. So let it sit on a shelf, because my intention was always to create the physical.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the digital physical. And I visited in we did it in Unreal Engine, and it was the first time I ever used Unreal Engine. And it's actually a brand new architectural tool, right? A gaming engine for architecture, go figure. And that's what that's the new sort of like tool, architectural tool as well. Amazing. So December of 2020 comes around, and I'm like, oh my God, I really want to discover more about blockchain and art. Because I'm just so like bothered by the fact that my digital art can be copied and, you know, anyone can own it. It's very stressful. So I Googled it, and NFTs came up. Went down that rabbit hole. Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness. There are galleries that sell NFTs. And mm-hmm. I'm like, I am so ready for this. Yeah. I'm here. I'm ready for this. Signed up to two online NFT galleries, super rare. I love them. And Known Origin. Known Origin rejected me, unfortunately.
It's
super rare. It happens, man. It's okay. Humbling. Hey, yeah. You know,
it good is for what growth. It is.
It's fine. Not everyone has to like you.
I know. You could be the sweetest peach in the world, and somebody out there still just doesn't like peaches.
It is what it is.
It took me 40 years to realize this.
Oh my goodness. Super Rare took me on. And so I minted my first artwork in February of 2020.
Mm-hmm.
And I was studying the landscape of NFTs at the time. And it was very, very rudimentary. Very, very like, you know, like baby crawling stage, okay? What it was you're basically uploading 100 megabyte JPEG files or video files, very low files, to the NFT, to the metadata, and that was your NFT. And I thought, we are so early. But I knew in that moment that NFTs would become 3D digital physical assets that are powered by AI. I knew that that's the future of NFTs, that it's enterprise solutions. It's not just these like JPEGs, but it's very, very early, which is really cool because there's always art. You know, you leave it to artists to always, you know, start the new thing, right?
Push boundaries.
It's new. I loved it. I was so enthralled by this new Web3 movement in the beginning, right in the beginning of the NFT movement, in the beginning of 2021 when it really started to take off. March of 2021, I thought, is the world ready for a 3D digital asset that's real estate? That's potentially going to be the framework for digital physical authentication or exchange of value. And that was the Mars House. So I minted the Mars House, and that was the hypothesis.
Love.
And then it was sold to AOI, and that made history.
It's incredible. And then what about, I mean, we are Vogue after all.
Yes.
So fashion.
Love.
What about becoming a Louis Vuitton visionary?
Oh my gosh, that was a huge honor.
Mm.
I thought it was a joke when they built me out. Is this for real? That was after the launch of the Mars House. That was soon afterward. They reached out to me, and they were celebrating the 200th anniversary of Louis Vuitton, the man, the founder of the brand. And so the whole campaign was to create 200 artworks that are based on the original trunk that Louis Vuitton created. They curated 200 creators, not just artists, but philosophers, activists, scientists. Like, it was really just a very incredible group of people, and I was so honored to be part of that group.
Yeah.
And that was just an honor. I just created a beautiful glass sculpture for them, and I spoke about the gradient, how the gradient represents what it means to be human in the digital age. And that, you know, this integration of digital physical life with the metaverse and in real life, like that's coming. And so that was my, you know, that was my contribution.
Wonderful.
And we did a global tour, every major city of Louis Vuitton, all the major flagship. They did a beautiful exhibition, and it was such an honor, such an incredible experience.
I do have a question from Chet Lowe. I thought this was so appropriate for you. What do you tell yourself at night?
Oh, wow. Actually, I really take my father's advice here. Did I live honorably today?
That is a wow.
Yeah.
That's really profound.
He's a very philosophical man. That's where I get it.
And I mean, he's pretty good with a samurai sword as well.
Yeah, he's very good with a samurai sword. He used to cut watermelons with his hand.
It's wild. So because this is a podcast series, are you able to give me a question for my next guest? It can be very generic.
Oh, yes.
Like, what is your coffee order? Or where do you see AI going? I don't know. Whatever resonates with you.
What is the change you'd like to see in the world in the next 10 years?
I know. I love. Okay.
I hope it's not too hard.
No, not at all. Vogue Uncut quickfire questions.
Oh, fun.
Yes. So I guess just answer with whatever first comes to mind.
Okay.
What is your greatest achievement?
You know, I think motherhood is certainly the greatest challenge of my life. And my children are older now. They're teenagers. So I think that the greatest achievement is just for them to be loving human beings, like just good people inside, intrinsically. Like that's so important to me. And now when I speak to them and I interact with them, you know, that's what I'm really proud of. But then also being able to balance a career as a mother.
I feel you.
Exactly.
What do you love most about AI?
I love that AI is going to, well, AI with data sovereignty, okay, is going to democratize accessibility, create a more just and fair world. I believe that we will have more democratization in the world of opportunities, and you will see more people thrive. I think that AI will bring out the human connection. We will elevate as a human species. Like that should be the whole point of all of this, not just making billions of dollars. I mean, screw you if that's all you care about. Like you really shouldn't be focusing on that. To elevate a human potential.
If you had to choose to live life in the real world or the metaverse with your consciousness, which one would you choose?
I like being here in this moment now. I mean, I don't believe that the metaverse should replace what we are now. I think that the digital physical lifestyle will be a thing, definitely. And that would be incredible. But if you're talking about like transhumanism and uploading our consciousness to a computer and all of that jazz, I don't care about living forever.
Mm.
What I do care is perhaps archiving and aggregating all of my information so that I can be of service to future generations if they have questions and could partake in my wisdom. And I could share that. That's great.
And your children.
Yes, my children.
A constant reference for the rest of their lives.
Absolutely. But all children.
Yeah.
All children. And so I'm not afraid of death. In fact, you know, the day that I die, I just want to make sure that I have contributed something, right, to the world, to my kids. I think that life and death are part of the same. Like we can only live a good life if we know that we are going to die.
It's coming back to that whole transmuting thing, isn't it? Or the yin and yang kind of thing.
The balance.
Yeah. There's always two sides to the coin.
Yeah, but I'm not interested in living forever. No.
What art form is capturing the zeitgeist in 2024?
The experiential.
Hmm.
Connecting to consciousness, bringing people together, experiences, spirituality, spiritual connection. Definitely, you know, I can't say, I don't like to say, oh, this art is better than this art. It's more special. It's better. No. Whatever art it is, whether it's sculpture or knitting or whatever you're creating, like, it's all beauty. But bring people together, express humanity, express what it means to be human in this age. But I do believe that right now people need experiences that mitigates loneliness and mental illness and the degradation of our mental health collectively. We have to address that. We have to do something about it.
And then finish the sentence. To me, digital art is.
To me, digital art is an extension of the human condition, an extension of our consciousness. That it is an art form that helps us make sense of the new technological era that we're living in. And digital art will help save us from ourselves in a world where disruption and technological advancement will accelerate at a level that we've never experienced before.
That is a very profound way to end our podcast here
today.
Oh,
thank you, Yvette.
But thank you so much, Krista Kim.
Such a pleasure, my dear.
It was amazing.
It was amazing. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Bye.